So let's start by discussing how the order of creation operators for bosons and fermions encodes the same property as the exchange symmetry that we discussed in position representation. So one way we can do this is, let's assume that we have two creation operators, CK1 dagger and CK2 dagger. Now they're acting on vacuum. So I'm just going to write vacuum for K1, vacuum for K2. Now these two operators, this operator is going to create a particle here. This operator is going to create a particle here. Let's assume these are fermions. So you will get the state 1 in K1, 1 in K2. Now let's change the order. This is CK2 dagger now, CK1 dagger. This again is going to give us the same state. Right? So in this second quantization, in this notation, it is difficult to see how this is related to exchange, how the order of these operators matters. To see this, if you have these states, one occupation number 1 in K1 and 1 in K2, you should always start from vacuum and see how this state is created. That will take you to these two options. And now to see that these two options are related to each other via exchange, we go to the position representation. So the position representation will be obtained by taking the position ket, the bra, and let's act this on CK1, CK2 dagger, 0K1, 0K2. Now, this is going to give you the position representation of this state, or the first one. And this is going to be, now you can say it's phi K1, R1, phi K2, R2. I can do the same for the other state. And now I will get K2. Right? So when we go to position representation, then it's clear that the order of the operators here will give you these two, and these two are related to each other by changing the coordinate. And because of the anti-commutation relation between the fermionic operators, you'll get that these two should be negative of each other, right? So just to clarify the notation, let me write it down here. When we write things like psi, the many-body wave function, R1, R2, till Rn. And if we write this many-body wave function as a sum over complete basis, so I have to sum over all quantum numbers, some coefficient, Kn, and then I have symmetrized operator or anti-symmetrization over states K1, K2, till Kn. What we really mean is that this, you should think of this, so on the left-hand side, you have something that depends on coordinates. On the right-hand side, you don't. So what this notation means is you have to think of this in position representation. So think of this as 1 over square root of n factorial, and then you have a determinant or permanent, and then here you have these, the wave functions, psi k1, r1, psi k1, rn, and then psi k n r1 psi k n rn. So if you have something on left hand side that is written in terms of as a function of coordinates, and on right hand side you don't have, you just have general ket, then think of them in their position representation to find a relation between the two. So is this clear enough now? Let me stress that the problem was just doing one more step, which is going to position representation. So we have gained a lot by doing the second quantization. We no longer have to worry about determinants and permanents, and we can simply use these operators, and their commutation or anti-commutation relation is going to encode the fundamental exchange symmetry between fermions and bosons. So also what we did yesterday was we want to write the various terms in the Hamiltonian in second quantized notation. So we discuss how we can write the single particle operator. We also discussed how we can write the two particle operator in terms of operators in second quantized notation. Now let's take an example. And the example we take is that we have n identical fermions. Is there a typo or something?
I was just wondering why CK1, CK2 applied to the vacuum and CK2, CK1 applied to the vacuum doesn't give the same state afterwards. Because if we apply the guys to the right type,
yeah,
then we just get the same inner product. So why do they give the...
So the way we will go to... So first we get a general ket. And then this ket, these two kets, they look identical. So these kets are just some general vectors in two-dimensional Hilbert space. They look identical just because the way the notation we chose to write them. When we go to position representation, these two are actually could be different because these two can correspond to these two different ways. So if I just write this, you can say that this can mean any of these two things. But this is not clear if you just write this, right?
Okay.
So you have to go to position representation and there the order will.
So what you mean is that just writing that, like those are not the same vectors in the image.
I mean, if they're bosons, they are the same vector.
Yep. Yeah. The occupation number, you can't even tell whether they're bosons or fermions, right? It's occupation number one. So once you have operators, then you can use the exchange, commutation and anti-commutation, go to position representation, and there you'll see the exchange statistics. So let's write down a first quantized, or let's write down the first quantized Hamiltonian for n identical particles that have two-body interactions. So consider n electrons, and the interactions can be the Coulomb interactions between the electrons. So the Hamiltonian in the first quantized form is going to be minus h bar square over 2m, sum over all particles, and I have the gradient square, plus I have I not equal to j, potential, now, this is the total Hamiltonian. So like we did discuss yesterday, it can be a sum of one single particle terms, two particle terms. If you want, you can have more complicated interactions also. But for the moment, we restrict ourselves to these two terms. And now, yesterday, we had a general formula, how to write these operators, how to write a general single and two particle terms in terms of operators. And the first step is to choose a complete single particle basis. So let's now choose the complete single particle basis to be the momentum eigenstates. So the complete basis that we are going to use for single particle states. What this means is, so this is a kit. I can go to the position representation. Then I will have phi k r. So the wave function corresponding to this kit is so omega here is the system volume. Now let's write down the single particle term in terms of using this basis as this as the complete basis. So what we have to do is we have to calculate these matrix elements, T, J, K. I'm putting vectors here because each basis element is labeled by a vector. So to calculate the matrix element of the single particle operator in terms of matrix elements between different single particle states, we can write this as phi j t phi k. Now we can calculate this matrix element in position representation. So when we go to position representation, this would become we can use as the wave function. This is the bra, so we can just write this as phi j r star. This is the operator. The operator in position representation has minus h bar square over 2m. It has the gradient operator. And this state now is simply, again, so we also have, this we can write as phi k r, right? Now, in this bracket notation, this is a scalar product. This is a inner product. This is a ket. This is a bra. When you go to position representation, this inner product corresponds to integrating over r. So think of the states are orthonormal. You have bra and ket. So when you have different states, psi m, this implies that when you integrate over space over the wave functions, you will get a delta function. So we just went to the position representation. Now this is easy to calculate. We'll just put back these functions here and let's try to do it. So this gradient, we have k, so we have ik here. So this gradient will pull out a factor of ik dot ik. And I square will cancel this. So we'll get h bar square, this vector k square over 2m. Then we'll have this factor 1 over omega. We'll have an integral over r. And we'll have e to the power I k minus j dot r. Right? Now, this integral is again a delta function. So what that means, right? What that means is that this operator, this matrix element is actually h bar square, can be written as h bar square k square divided by 2m delta k j. Right? So the kinetic energy, now we have the expression for it. The total kinetic energy operator is simply going to be sum over J and K T J K, we had C J dagger C K. So because of the delta function, we just get sum over K H bar square K square over 2M C K dagger C K. So now we can do the same thing for the two particle operator, that is the potential. We can think of this as the Coulomb potential. So we discussed that the two particle terms, they can be written as now sum over, let's say, K1. So now you have to sum over four quantum numbers, Q1, Q2. We have matrix elements. We can write them as Q1, Q2, K1, K2. And then we have four operators here. So in the tutorial yesterday, you used conservation of momentum and definition of Fourier transform of the potential. And you showed that this term is actually identical to writing sum over K, K prime, and Q, V tilde, Q, C dagger, K prime minus Q, C dagger, K plus Q, C K prime, C K. Where this V tilde Q is Fourier transform of the interaction potential. So this was done in tutorial yesterday. You can think of this interaction term. You can just this term, you can depict in terms of a Feynman diagram. So what we are seeing here are two states coming in and two new states created. So you can draw a diagram like a state coming in, and this is the state K, and then there's an interaction. There's another state coming in. This is with momentum K prime. And then the outgoing states are this one is K prime minus Q. This one is K plus Q. That means a momentum Q is traveled, has been transferred from this one to this one. So I can write this. Also, the strength for this process is given by the Fourier transform, which is the Q. Now, there are many ways to depict such an interaction term in terms of Feynman diagram. Here, keep in mind that typically in condensed matter, we use time on y-axis. So the incoming states are below, outgoing states are above. You can also draw Feynman diagrams typically in high energy. The convention is to use incoming states on the left and outgoing on the right, so the time is on the horizontal axis. So when you see a Feynman diagram, keep in mind what are incoming states, what are outgoing states. This depends on whether time is along the horizontal axis or the vertical axis. So this is basically a scattering of two incoming states with momentum k and k prime, and then the outgoing states k plus q, k prime minus q, and a transfer of momentum q. So now that we have gone through the trouble of formally, so the reason we are, or I'm introducing all of these, and you might have seen this in other courses, is just because we want the notation to be consistent. So next 10 minutes or 5 or 10 minutes, we can extend now this notation to define field operators. So this is relatively straightforward. Any questions so far? So this is just a way to show this term. And for condensed matter, this is actually one of the most important interactions, because typically we deal with electrons, they are charged, and they influence each other via Coulomb interactions. So now let's go one step further and let's define field operators. And the goal here is that we can write this Hamiltonian in first quantized form. We were defining all these, this formalism. So first, we can write now the same Hamiltonian in terms of this plus this. We are now going to define field operators, so then we can write the same Hamiltonian in terms of field operators. And the reason we are doing that is to perform calculations. It's actually useful to go to either the field operators or these operators. So let's define these field operators as psi of r is sum over k phi k r ck. And psi dagger r is so this is our definition, and these phi k's are defined here. Now, these ck, dagger, and ck, they create a particle with momentum k and annihilate a particle with momentum k. Similarly, these psi dagger and psi, they create a particle at coordinate r and annihilate a particle at coordinate r. So if you create a particle using this field operator, psi dagger r acting on vacuum, you're creating a particle at location r. This is actually same as sum over k, phi k star r, so creating a particle at r is same as creating a particle with arbitrary momentum. This can be seen from this equation. So creating a particle r, we have a superposition state, and it's a superposition of all possible momentums k. So this is in agreement with what we expect from Heisenberg's uncertainty relation, that if you know the location, the momentum should be completely arbitrary. And we can do one more thing. So we have defined the field operators. We must now define their commutation or anti-commutation relation. Now, because these are the way I've defined so far, these are fermionic operators. So for these field operators, you would have anti-commutation relations. Now, this we know is a delta function. So this is rather straightforward. You can just, you will just get one sum, k, and then you have the volume factor from the two wave functions, and then you have e to the power I k dot r minus r prime. This sum can be converted to an integral. And this integral is a delta function again. So I think most of you have seen this. The reason I'm still doing this is to make sure we understand all the steps and the notation. So this will be used frequently in this course. Sum over k in three dimensions can be converted into an integral divided by two. So sum over k times 1 over volume can be written as an integral in k space in three dimensions. So if you have two dimensions, you will have d2k, 2 pi square, and for one dimensions, only one factor. So if you had bosonic field operators, then you would have commutation relation. So now that we have all this, we can write down the Hamiltonian in terms of these field operators. So one way to do that is to invert these two definitions and write CK and CK dagger in terms of the field operators. So this can be done if we, for example, here, let's multiply by e to the power minus iq dot r and integrate. So let's do that. Just take second. So we have psi r, the field operator. This is sum over k, phi k r, c k. This is sum over k, 1 over square root omega, e to the power I k dot r, c k. Now, I want to multiply by e to the power minus iq dot r and integrate over r. So when I do this here, so this is again a delta function. So what I get here is simply 1 over square root of omega. So this quantity, this integral over r, is a delta function kq times the volume. So when I put this back, I can directly write the result. I will get square root omega cq. So we have just inverted the definition of field operators. So we get cq 1 over square root omega d cube r e to the power minus iq dot r. So now we already know the Hamiltonian in terms of these operators, C and this. So we can put these definitions and get the Hamiltonian. So you can check this home. Let me just write down the result. So the kinetic energy, the total, this comes out to be an integral d cube r psi dagger r minus h bar square over 2m gradient square, and the field operator r. the total potential energy this you will find this will involve two integrals d cube of r and d cube r prime and you will have psi dagger r then you will have the potential r minus r prime So we have seen three ways of writing down the Hamiltonian. First quantized form, we can go to use momentum eigenstates and write down in second quantized form. With momentum eigenstates, we can also write down in, there's another way of writing the second quantized form in terms of field operators. So now we still have to solve it. This is just a general Hamiltonian we have written. So rest of the course, we'll be using all of this and we'll be solving Hamiltonians for special cases. And we will discover that various properties, physical properties like superconductivity, phonons, the new particles that we talked about in the first class, they all can be derived by just solving these complicated Hamiltonians. So any questions so far? So now let's start simple. So what we want to discuss is how do solids behave at low temperature? Now, what is a solid? So think of a solid as made up of ions. And so we start with atoms, and then we have ions. The atoms, they have valence electrons. Imagine that these valence electrons are free to move around, and that leaves an ion. So in solids, you have ions that are usually arranged in a periodic way, and you have electrons that are free to move around. So what I mean is, okay, so now we are talking about electrons in a periodic potential. So let me move this up. So you can think of ions as being arranged in a periodic way. Let's take an example that they're arranged in this. So these dots are where ions are located. And then there is a plane in front and going back. So we have three-dimensional space. And we have a cubical lattice, which is regularly spaced points. And on each of these points, you have an ion sitting in. This is an example of solid. And all the valence electrons, they are free to move in the space all around the ions. So this is a model of solid. Using this model, we can calculate some quantities theoretically, and we'll see if experimentalists measure the same things. So usually the calculations we'll do are in good agreement with the experiments. So we have some faith in these models. Now, one can ask the question, why ions are arranged in this way? Well, ions are charged. If you have atoms on this lattice, atoms are not charged, but still different atoms, an atom here can interact with all other atoms. So if two atoms come close to each other, they will interact by a van der Waals interaction. Imagine if you have charged ions, they will interact via Coulomb forces, via Coulomb interaction. So if you start with ions that are not in a lattice, but each ion is still interacting with all other ions, what you will get is a potential energy that is a function of distance between each ion. And this potential energy is coming from the interaction between the ions. at low temperature, this way of arranging the ions minimizes this potential energy. So the reason you get this lattice is that this arrangement minimizes the potential energy. Now, what kind of lattice you have? This would depend on the type of ion you have. So depending on whether you have sodium or potassium or some other metal, depending on what material or what atom, what ion you have, you can have different lattices. Any questions so far? So to move forward, we'll need a bunch of definitions. So let's go ahead and define these things. So we start with that model of lattice. So what we have is basically points which are arranged in a periodic way, in a periodic manner in three-dimensional space. So what we need is we need to choose a coordinate system and a way to define the location of these points. So we do that by defining vectors. So first, there is a concept called Bravais lattice. What Bravais lattice means, or what the definition of Bravais lattice is, it's a lattice that is identical from each site. So if you stand on one of these lattice sites, look around you, go to another lattice site, look around you, you'll have the same view. If a lattice has this property, this is called a Bravais lattice. For a Bravais lattice, we can define something that is called lattice vector. So lattice vectors would be denoted by vector R, and this vector is defined to be some integer n1 times a vector a1 plus some integer n2 times vector a2, some integer n3 times a vector a3. n1, n2, n3, these are integers. A1, A2, A3, these are called primitive lattice vectors. So these vectors, why do we need them? Using these vectors, you can get to any of the point in the lattice. So the points that are spanned, so the point is we'll first choose these three. So the way we start is by we'll choose three vectors, A1, A2, A3. These are primitive lattice vectors, and these define the fundamental symmetry of the crystal itself. Using these three vectors, you can multiply these three vectors with three integers. You can get many other vectors using these three vectors. These vectors will, all the points spanned by these vectors are, that is, for example, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and all possible values. All these integers will correspond to all of those points. We'll take an example, and these concepts will become more clear. Now, because we have a periodic system, by periodic, I mean you jump to another, or you go to another lattice side, you look around, you see that everything is same as it was from other lattice side. So there is some periodicity in the system. And because of this periodicity, it is useful to go to the Fourier space. So we'll define, so we can go to, so the real space, this is called direct space. We can also, let's go to Fourier space. Or you can call it K-space. This is also referred to as reciprocal space. So in the real space, in direct space, you have a bunch of points in the lattice points. The Fourier transform, or in the Fourier space, also, you'll have a bunch of points. And now you want to specify these points. So the way we define these points in Fourier space is we will need to specify a vector similar to this. So we'll define this by what is called reciprocal lattice vectors. And we'll use the notation G. So a reciprocal lattice vector G is defined as some three integers M1 times three vectors B1, B2, B3. So we have M1, B1, M2, B2, M3, B3. Again, M1, M2, M3, these are integers, and these B1, B2, B3, these are primitive reciprocal lattice vectors. Now, the definition of this Fourier space, the way we define these points in K space or in reciprocal space, is that E, the defining property is E to the power G dot R is 1. So if you take a general vector, or if you take any lattice vector R, and you take any reciprocal lattice vector G, because the reciprocal space is Fourier transform of the direct space, this must hold. So using this, we can calculate the primitive reciprocal lattice vectors in terms of these vectors A1. So we know this must be true. So basically, you have this G, put that in, put R in, put R, this expression for R, and then solve this equation. Solving this equation, you can calculate B1, B2, B3 in terms of A1, A2, A3. So I can just write down the solution. So B1, you can calculate, it comes out to be 2 pi A2 cross A3. B2, So these are some general expressions for three-dimensional lattice. So the starting point is to choose primitive lattice vectors, A1, A2, A3, and from that, you can derive all the other things needed to discuss the properties of solids. Now you can, in the tutorial on Thursday, you will take one concrete example, and that will correspond to a two-dimensional lattice, which is lattice for the material called graphene. And you will derive various properties of the solid using this framework. Now, we can take another example just to clarify things and move forward and discuss more concepts. Now, in two dimension, so let's take two dimensions. It's easier to draw on board. And we'll take the example of triangular or hexagonal lattice. So what we mean by this is basically lattice points arranged in this way. So if you have this arrangement of lattice sites, this is called hexagonal or triangular lattice. This is not equal to honeycomb lattice. In the tutorial, you will discuss this honeycomb lattice. Honeycomb lattice is, you have points arranged in hexagon. So if you look closely, you will see this is not same as this. In fact, what is missing is if I add lattice sites in the center of these hexagons, I will get the triangular lattice back. So honeycomb lattice, so you will see these words, people call honeycomb lattice and hexagonal or triangular lattice. Keep in mind they are different. These, you can put lattice sites in the center of these hexagons and then you'll get back to the triangular lattice. Now this way of drawing various symmetries of lattice, we can draw the lattice and think about various symmetries in it. This leads us to an important concept, which is, remember how we define Bravais lattice. We said you stand on the lattice side, look around, whatever you see should be the same view if you go on any other lattice side. So by the way, these are all infinite in both directions. So just keep repeating them. And same thing here. So I'm here. What I see is I have six equidistant neighbors, two along horizontal line, two above, two below. I go here, I see the same thing. Two on horizontal, two above, two below. And in fact, all lattice sites will have the same surrounding, same view around it. But let's do the same thing for here. I stand here, what do I see? I see an ion along the horizontal line, one here, one here. Let's go back to this site. Here, I see something else. I don't see anything here. In fact, I see the mirror view of that. I see something to the left and two on the right. So on this lattice, the symmetry is such that each side is not identical. So this lattice is not a Bravais lattice. You can define so the way we'll move forward with a lattice like this, which is not a Bravais lattice, is that we'll extend the unit cell. So this leads us to an important concept, which is unit cell. So what unit cell is, it's group of let's say, lattice points. Or rather, minimum number. It's the group of lattice points, or minimum number, or the smallest group of lattice points, which can be repeated to produce the whole crystal. So here I can take these three lattice points, and I can repeat them. I can do this, I can repeat this, then I can flip it and repeat and do all these operations. And from just three lattice sites, I can create everything else. Here, I cannot do this with just three lattice sites. So I enhance the unit cell, and if the unit cell has 6 points, I can translate it and create the whole thing. So the unit cell for these two lattice is different. And now, if we cleverly choose this unit cell as something that is larger, and at each lattice site, I assume that at each lattice site, I can have more than one atom. There is a representation of this honeycomb lattice in terms of a Bravais lattice. And this is what you would do in the tutorial. So there is a way around to write this lattice in terms of these vectors, such that everything we have discussed so far works out. And the only thing that you would do is you would have to assume that each site, for example, so the idea is, for example, you will absorb this site in this site. So as if this site does not exist anymore, this does not exist anymore, this does not exist anymore. What you will get is, so what I mean by does not exist anymore is that you assume that each lattice site comes with 2 atoms, one exactly at the site and one right of it. So this is also called basis. So this is another example of lattice with a basis, which means at each lattice site, you have more than one atom or ion, you have more than one particle. So more on this in the tutorial. So any questions so far? So by the way, we'll only cover few topics related to this. There is a whole field of crystallography where you can try to figure out various symmetries of these lattice points, and those various symmetries will impose some important constraints for the wave functions that electron moving in such a periodic lattice can have. So there are many interesting things that we can just discover from properties of these lattice points. So for graphene, it turns out you'll figure out that this arrangement, what it does is it gives rise to a dispersion for electrons, which is relativistic. So far, our kinetic energy was k square over 2m. You'll find out for graphene, it will be linear in momentum. Energy would be linear in momentum. So there can be very interesting consequences just from this lattice symmetry. So let's discuss this more in tutorial. Let's go back to this. And let's just, for clarity, write down. We'll only do it once for 2D, maybe once for 1D. And then we'll use it for rest of the course. So if we have this triangular lattice, let's assume it goes on and on. Let's choose an origin. So we choose this as origin. Let's choose a coordinate system. This is x, this is y. So now, the way we move forward is first we have to define primitive lattice vectors, right? So we choose the primitive lattice vectors here as this one. We'll call this A1. This one which we call A2. Here. So A1, and let's assume that the distance between two points is given by A. So A1, what I mean by that is A1, the vector A1 is A times x hat. So this I can also write as A1, 0. A2 is going to be vector A. This angle is 60 degrees. Basically, A by 2. Now, what we defined here is lattice vectors. They span all of the points in this crystal lattice. So these lattice vectors, they're basically N1 times A1 plus N2 times A2. To see that starting from this origin, let's prove or let's apply this concept. So if I start from this point, which is origin, to this point, if I add a vector A1, which corresponds to 1, so this point itself corresponds to 0, 0, N1 and N2 being 0 and 0. If N1 is 1 and N2 is 0, you get this point, right? So this point is simply vector A1. This point is simply vector A2. You can get to this point, or let me write down actually the integers that correspond. So this integer also corresponds to 0, 0 for N1 and N2. This point corresponds to integers 1, 0. So N1 is 1 and 2 is 0. This point corresponds to integers 2, 0, right? So similarly, this point, it corresponds to minus 1, 0, and so on. What about this point? This point corresponds to 0, 1. This point corresponds to 0, 2, and so on. What about this point? Well, this point corresponds to 1 here, and then 1, this one. This is simply 1, 1. This point corresponds to minus 1, 1. This point corresponds to 2, A2, minus A1. So minus 1 and 2. So this is what I meant by saying that that direct lattice vectors span the entire lattice. So by choosing these integers, you can reach all of these points. Now you can also define, so we can also go to reciprocal space and the G, they will be written as M1, B1 plus M2, B2. Now, these reciprocal lattice vectors, they are defined using e to the power I G dot R equal to 1. This, if you put these expressions, you will get M1, N1 times B1 dot B2. So go through the algebra, you'll find that this is equivalent to saying that bi dot aj is equal to 2 pi delta ij. So just put this expression of g, this expression for r, and you'll see that this is simply e to the power I m1 n1 b1 dot a1 e to the power I m2 n1 b2 dot a1 e to the power I m1 n2 b1 a2 and e to the power I m2 n2 b2 a2. So if you choose b1 dot a bi dot aj to 2 pi delta ij, this is 0, e to the power 0, 1, this is 0, d these two will be 2 pi, and you get 1. So using this, we can actually, this property, we can actually calculate these b1s and b2. So I will just write down the result here. Is this clear how we can do this? So let me write down the result. What will you can go and do this vector calculation. You will find that b1 comes out to be 4 pi square root 3a times square root 3 by 2 minus half, and b2 comes out to be 4 pi by square root 3a zero, 1. So now we know b1, b2 also. So we can go to reciprocal lattice corresponding to this. The reciprocal space for this hexagonal or triangular lattice is also going to be hexagonal or triangular lattice. Any questions so far? Yes.
Sorry. How do you know that the dot product has to be, like A1 dot B2 has to be 0? But
so we choose these vectors. So we could have chosen A1 and A2 in a different way also. A1 this way, this. But we chose A1, A2 to be this. So we know this is the constraint that reciprocal lattice vectors must satisfy, and this choice does the job. So there's still some freedom to choose reciprocal lattice vectors.
I see.
So that's a good question. So yeah, we can. There are many ways of describing the lattice. So that's the reason all of the description is going to be in terms of R and G, which will be very general because R and G have this property, GR that one, this property. But depending on what are these R and Gs, that will depend on what A1, A2, B1, B2 are. So that is up to you. You can choose whatever you find convenient. So any questions so far? So in the remaining of this class, I'm going to prove something what is called Bloch's theorem. So this is something you might have heard and seen. There are many ways to prove this. And this is very useful in such systems because it applies to periodic systems. So if you have a system that is periodic, then the wave functions of that system must obey Bloch's theorem. So now, okay, this was all just formulation, how to describe discrete points, solids, and so on. Now let's go back to electrons. Electrons that we discussed earlier, we know how to write down the Hamiltonians in different forms. We know how to think of the kinetic energy. Now electrons in this model, they can be anywhere. So far, they are moving around in the space between these points. So let's write down Hamiltonian of a single electron. So this will be still single particle terms in those expressions. So this Hamiltonian is Hamiltonian for a single electron moving in this lattice. Now this Hamiltonian, let's start with the first quantized form. We have kinetic energy, plus we'll have a potential energy. Actually, let me use U, capital U here. So we'll reserve V for two particle interaction. So this potential U, can we say something about it? Yes. Why we can say something about it is because where is this potential coming from? This potential is coming from ions. These ions are located at periodic sites, at these lattice sites. for example, here or here. So you have ions sitting here. They give rise to the potential that a single electron moving in this space sees, right? So if a single electron, whether it's here, 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 it will see the same potential. What that means is the Hamiltonian for the single electron has a potential energy term that must satisfy this property. So the potential that electron feels has the same periodicity as that of the underlying lattice. This is because the underlying lattice is giving rise to this potential. This potential is coming from the ions that are sitting here. Any questions? Now, this must be true for all direct lattice vectors, right? Now, let us define a new operator. Let's define a translation operator. Let's call this operator TR. And what this operator does is this operator will act on a function of R, and the output would be a function R plus R. So it does what it says. It translates the coordinate R by this argument. This subscript here is by how much it will translate. So next, what we are going to do is we're going to find out some properties of this translation operator. It's relatively straightforward. So if we apply a translation of R to some function R, we'll get F of R plus R. What if I now apply a translation of R prime? I will get this. Right? Let's do it in reverse. I'll get F of R plus R prime. And now I will apply translation of R. Right? These are both the same thing. What we have simply proven is that translation operators for different direct lattice vectors must commute. Right? Next, we are going to prove that this translation operator must commute with the Hamiltonian also. So let me do this also here. So let's apply this translation operator, TR, to the Hamiltonian. Now, the Hamiltonian that I've written there is a function of R. And let's apply it to this whole. So now I'm applying it to H times the wave function psi of R. If I do this, what I would expect is translation of all of this. So I should get H R plus R psi R plus R. Right? Now, what is Hamiltonian HR plus R? The Hamiltonian contains two terms. The first term is a differential term. It has derivatives. The derivatives do not change under translation. The potential is a function of R, So that will change when you substitute R to R plus R. But we have this. So this is actually same as H of R times psi of R plus R. This can be written as H of R translation on psi of R. So what we have proven here is that this translation operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. And this is true for all lattice vectors R. Any questions so far? So now, again, we know if we find an operator that commutes with the Hamiltonian, that means we can choose eigenstates that are simultaneous eigenstates of both the Hamiltonian and the translation operator, right? So let's start with the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So we choose these eigenstates. Let's label them with N and K. This is our choice. Our, the eigenvalues are En, K, psi n. Now, because we have this commutation, we can, these eigenstates, so now we choose these eigenstates psi n k r such that they are simultaneous eigenstates of both the Hamiltonian and the translation operator. So this means that same eigenstates acting on this translation operator r acting on these eigenstates psi n k r will give us some eigenvalue. So there must be eigenstates. And these eigenvalues, let's choose them in this form. I mean, they are still very general. I'm just writing them. So the eigenvalues will depend on K and the trans by the amount you're translating R. And this is the coordinate here. So this is just a way of choosing. This is still a very general eigenvalue, right? Any questions so far? Now, let's impose the constraint that these wave functions are normalized. So what that means is integral d cube r psi n k r absolute value square. This should be 1. Now, in this integral, I can substitute. So what I do in this step is I define, instead of r, I go to r equal to r prime plus r. So I change variables. If I change variables, what I get is integral over r prime now, psi n k r prime plus r. So because the integral is over the entire space from minus infinity to infinity, nothing really changes here. We've just done this, right? Any questions about this? So we are also assuming these are well-behaved eigenstates, as in they don't blow up at infinity. So by changing just by translation by a lattice vector, you're not going to get any non-analytical behavior at the boundaries, at the infinities. Yep. Yes.
So you have the C depends on R.
Yeah.
But if you have different Rs, won't the eigenvectors be?
So the eigenvalues can be different for different Rs. But
the eigenvectors might also be different, huh?
So eigenvectors, so let's forget this at all. So this is, the reason that happens is because TR commutes with H for all R. It does not, So we started with eigenstates of Hamiltonian, which only depend on this. We chose nk. But because tr commutes with h for all r, only that's why we can choose this to be independent of cap. But you're right. If it was for only for a special r that tr commuted, then it would have this index capital R also. Does that answer your question?
No, I just, I mean, like, the wave functions, so the wave functions, the eigenfunctions might be different for different R's.
They all commute to each other, right?
Yeah.
Like the TR commutes with TR prime and commutes with the Hamiltonian, I think.
So here we are choosing.
Yeah.
So we are not trying to calculate eigenvectors of TR. If you would do that, you may find eigenvectors depend on R. We are not doing that. We are choosing eigenstates of Hamiltonian such that they are simultaneous eigenstates of TR. And this we can do for all R. And this we can do because they commute for all R. So for all R is the important part. So now we are almost there. So this.
It's also important that the T's commute with each other, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's also, if you try to calculate, substitute at psi here, then you'll see that if you try to do for different R's, you can also use the property that translation operators for different R's commute with each other. So you can move them around. So now this term here can be rewritten in terms of translation operator. So this, we can write this as tr acting on psi nk r prime square. This is actually equal to integral d cube r prime. This we know is this here. So we have c k r times this psi n k r prime square. Now, let me write it here. This implies that now, because we started with normalization, I'm going to put 1 here. So this quantity should be equal to 1. What this quantity is, now this does not depend on r prime. I can take it outside the integral. So I just have ck r square integral d cube r prime psi nk r prime square. This is again the normalization condition. So what we have proven here, that these eigenvalues, they must obey the constraint that their absolute value square must be equal to 1. Right? Now what that means is you can choose these eigenvalues as some complex number, modulo unity. So I can also write this as an exponential. Let's choose this angle to be 2 pi theta k r. Right? So it says that if I take absolute value square, this is always unity, right? Now, let's use the property that you have a question? No. Now let's use the property that the different translation operators commute. So we have T of R prime acting on psi nk r. So they commute. In fact, not only they commute, they can also be written like this. Right? So you can just look at these definitions here, these functions. I can write translation operators like this also. Now we are very close to be done. What this means is now let's put back, so TR acting on this will give you the eigenvalue. It's an eigenstate of TR prime. So it will give you a eigen. So because they commute, you can do it in any way. So TR prime, it will give you a factor CKR prime. This will give you a factor CKR. So you can, this implies that CKR times CKR prime must be equal to CKR plus R prime. Right? So this is an eigenstate of TR prime. So you get the CKR prime. Then this acting on it will give CKR. This acting on this, it's again the eigenstate of translation operators. So R plus R prime is also, this is also a translation operator. So you'll get CKR plus R prime. Now we know what this function must be. So this is a product of two functions with different arguments that gives us the same function with the argument of the sum. We know what function does that. That's the exponential function. So we have basically found what these CKs must be. So these CKR must be equal to e to the power I k dot r. This implies that these theta kr must be k dot r divided by 2 pi. Right? Yes.
How do you know that it should be k there in the exponential?
So because in the what does not change in the exponential between these two is k.
There could be any like.
You can, there can, yes, there can be some other phase. You can put some constant factor there also. That would just add a phase. So there could be another phase here for sure. So we have fixed the function, functional form up to an arbitrary phase. Any other questions? Yes.
How do you know that C doesn't depend on N?
C doesn't, sorry.
How do you know that the C doesn't depend on N, like when you define your eigenvalues?
So this is an eigenstate YC. So so far N has, I could have written everything without N also. It doesn't. So the reason I wrote N is that I will use it later. So it's an assumption. You can put, it's an, you can do everything, just put an N here also. So far N is fixed in, so later on we'll discuss N is something called the band index. So, but for the moment we don't need it, but you're right. In general, you will have an index N, so just assume there is a superscript N on it also. But it will not change. The functional form, if you put an N here, you can say this will be KN, but that's it. Okay, so now what that means is that the translation of this eigenstate psi and kr is equal to c kr psi and kr. This is the translation on this. What does this give us? This will give us psi and k. Okay, let me write it here. So translation on this means it's psi and k, r plus r. This should be equal to, this I put here, e to the power I k dot r psi n k Now, this is what is called Bloch's theorem. So what we have proven is a general property for eigenstates for single particles that are moving in periodic potential. These eigenstates must satisfy this property. Right? Now, there was this question about phase. There could be some phase here, but these are properties written in terms of eigenstates. So eigenstates can have some arbitrary phase. When we'll calculate any expectation value of any observable, this phase will disappear. So there is, if you look at Bloch's theorem in online or at various books, I think typically this form is not presented, but another form of Bloch's theorem is presented, which is written this way. Psi n k r is equal to e to the power I k dot r times u n k r, where u n k r is same as u n k r plus r. This is another formulation of Bloch's theorem. What it says is that you can choose eigenstates of electron moving in a periodic potential in a form such that you have plane wave times another function, and this function must have the periodicity of the underlying lattice. So this is what this statement is saying. And we can see that this is same formulation. This is just a different formulation of the same thing. It's quite easy to see this. Let's just write it down. So what will be psi nk? So we can always write psi nk. So this is another formulation of Bloch's theorem. Now I can always write any function psi nk r in terms of e to the power ik dot r times another function of r. So far I'm not specifying any property for u. Let's assume I can write any function as a product of plane wave times another function. This is just substitution. So now what I can do is, this means that psi nk r plus r, this must be e to the power I k r plus r . Right? Now, let's use this form here. What this means is that this must be equal to this here. That means this must be equal to e to the power I k dot r times psi n k r. Now, what is psi n k r? We just chose this form. So it's e to the power I k r plus r u n k r, which implies, so this implies that u n k r must be equal to u n k r plus r. right? So I've just shown that these two forms are identical. So what we have learned today is that in solids, we have periodically arranged ions and electrons moving around. For the moment, let's ignore electron-electron interactions, the two-body term. We are going to come back maybe tomorrow or day after to that. That's going to give us very interesting phenomena. But for the moment, let's ignore electron-electron interactions and just take the single particle terms. If we just include the single particle terms, the wave functions must be chosen in this form, or the wave functions must obey this property. Any questions? So this is a good place to stop. We'll start tomorrow.